Good evening, everyone. I'm Lynor Mdou, and welcome to a new episode of Health Chat. We are glad to bring you new programming after a break due to the coronavirus pandemic, as we observed social distancing. We resume today with our virtual town hall discussion held last month to discuss the COVID-19 outbreak and look at how Africa is addressing this major health crisis. Here is part one of the town hall during a special episode of Straight Talk Africa. Take a listen. The ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is posing a global challenge never seen before in this century, as health authorities around the world are grappling to contain the outbreak. Confirmed cases of the virus have surpassed 1.3 million globally, and more than 73,000 have died from the viral disease. Now, the good news, over 270,000 people have recovered. In Africa, COVID-19 has infected at least 9,000 people. More than 400 have lost their lives to the virus, but over 900 have survived. So far, Africa has the world's lowest burden of COVID-19 cases, but the virus is showing no signs of slowing down. As the coronavirus spreads, so do myths and misinformation. Today, our experts will address some of them and answer your questions. But first, countries across the continent have imposed a wide range of measures to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, including closing schools, imposing travel restrictions, and curfews. Straight Talk Africa's Paul Ndio has the details.
Most of the world knew little about COVID-19 last December, when reports of a new deadly virus started to surface in Wuhan, China. Since then, however, it has spread across the world, disrupting daily lives of millions of people. Many of them are now under lockdown measures meant to slow the spread of the virus. The highly contagious coronavirus is now threatening to spread across Africa. Dr. Amita Taka is the chairperson of the Nairobi-based Africa Health Business. He says Africa requires a united approach to fight COVID-19.
I think everyone, government, private sector, civil society, development partners are all on the forefront and preparing to ensure that we flatten the curve. As you know, the ability of our health systems is even weaker than many of the countries that have faced high levels of mortality.
The World Health Organization says the impact of a major epidemic across Africa could be devastating. Most of the continent's healthcare systems are still ill-equipped to care for what could be an overwhelming number.
We should scale up our preparedness, but let's look at Kenya, for example, where I am. Our president and the Minister of Health, leading the government efforts, are totally on the ball about what's happening on corona. The private sector has regrouped itself in an organized manner to provide the support it needs. There are measures being taken to try and prevent transmission. As you know, in Africa right now, we are focusing on the big three goals. The first goal is prevent transmission. The second goal is prevent death. And the third one is preventing social harm. All our activities are geared towards these three goals.
COVID-19 has killed tens of thousands of people, according to Johns Hopkins Medical Center. But over 270,000 people have recovered from the disease. Dr. Laura Tani Rimak, a family physician based in Saskatchewan, Canada, says Africa is still ground zero, even though medical professionals and governments are doing their best.
So there are three steps. It's testing. It is also having access to the result. And then if you have it, you have to be staged in terms of severity and treated. But also if you don't have it, we want to prevent you having it. Or if you have mild symptoms, then you also have to be socially isolated to prevent its spread.
Dr. Tani Rimak warns that Africans need to change their mindset.
That this virus is aggressive. It is a killer. It is a paradigm shift. It is not about panic. It is about calming down to realize that this virus is it travels in the air, this air that we all breathe.
Many countries are facing a severe shortage of masks and other personal protective equipment as the coronavirus infects more people and claims more lives. Social media outlets are teaming up with countries on the continent to fight the misinformation about COVID-19 on social media platforms. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Now I'm pleased to introduce our guests. From Durban, South Africa, we are joined by Dr. Salim Abdul Karim, epidemiologist and director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa, CAPRISA. From New York City, we are joined by Dr. Sion Firu, doctor of emergency medicine and advisor to Ethiopia's Minister of Health on Emergency Care and Strategic Partnership. In Abuja, in Nigeria, we have Dr. Ibrahim Abubakar Kana, Director and National Program Manager for Saving 1 Million Lives Program for Results, a World Bank-funded project in Nigeria's Federal Ministry of Health. Also joining us today from Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, is Dr. Mumuni Niaone, Executive Director of Pool for Progress Burkina Faso, and also Behavioral Social Health Specialist. A warm welcome to you all for joining us on this special edition of Straight Talk Africa. Thank you so much for joining us. To you, our viewers, you can join the conversation on social media with the hashtag VOA Coronavirus Africa. Dr. Karim, let me start with you. South Africa currently has the highest rate of coronavirus infection in Africa. Can you give us a quick overview of where things stand currently?
Sure. The first case of the coronavirus infection was detected in South Africa just about a month ago on the 5th of March. It grew initially very slowly, but we reached about 100 cases in just over a week. And since then, it has grown quite rapidly. In the last few days, the numbers of new cases have steadily declined. And that's largely a function of the first epidemic, which was mainly among travelers. So most of the cases we have now, it's just under 1,700 cases, were among those who traveled overseas and came back positive, and then some of their contacts.
Okay.
But over the last few days, we've now seen community transmission. So the virus is now transmitting at a community level, and we expect to see those cases in the next wave.
Very important point. We went from travel infection to community transmission, and we'll talk more about that during the discussion. Now to you, Dr. Tsion. You are a special advisor to Ethiopia's Minister of Health. What is the current situation of the COVID-19 outbreak in Ethiopia?
Okay. So in Ethiopia, our first case was on March 13, and in the past, 3.5 weeks now, total cases as of this morning is 52 cases, and we've had 2 deaths so far. One thing I would say is Ethiopia has established the Emergency Operations Center, activated the Emergency Operations Center as of January 27, because Ethiopia was identified as a high-risk country because it's an international hub. Flights continue to other parts of China, and also lots of traffic to the airport. So the screening at the airports were very vigilant from the very beginning. And now, as of a week and almost 2 weeks ago, the government issued that any traveler that comes from abroad should be quarantined at a hotel. So the few cases that we've seen in the past few days are from people that have arrived in the past 2 weeks and that are on quarantine at this hotel.
Okay.
So we've been able to detect a lot of travelers coming from abroad where they're already contained inside a hotel, and they'll be monitored for 14 days from arrival.
All right, and we'll see more what measures are being put in place in Ethiopia. Now to you, Dr. Kana. Nigeria was the first country in sub-Saharan Africa to have a case of COVID-19. What is the latest on the outbreak in your country?
Thank you very much. As of yesterday night, 9:30 p.m., Nigeria actually recorded 238 cases, out of which, as of that yesterday also, we have discharged about 35 patients. And Nigeria has recorded so far 5 deaths. Incidentally, most of the over 60% of the cases recorded in Nigeria are actually patients or rather travelers that came into the country. I must quick to say here that the first recorded case in Nigeria was actually an Italian who actually worked in the country. And he came in through Lagos Airport. And he traveled down to a state called Ogun State, which is a state, neighboring state to Lagos State. But you see, government was very proactive at that time, you know, to quickly address or rather to track all the contacts that the first in death case actually made. That actually helped us greatly. Again, we are coming from Ebola. If you recall, Nigeria did very well in the control of Ebola, even when most of the people around the world felt Nigeria would not be able to control Ebola, but we brought Ebola to its knees and we controlled Ebola within a short period of time.
And we'll definitely see the lessons learned from Ebola, and this is something that we will touch on, Dr. Kana. Thanks. Now, let's go to Dr. Nyaone in Burkina Faso. Your country recorded the first death of COVID-19 in sub-Saharan Africa on March 18. Give us a sense of where the country is with the coronavirus outbreak as of now.
Okay, so right now we have 364 cases with 18 people who died from coronavirus, and we have 108 people who recovered from the disease. And the first case came in March, the 9th of March, and it started with some travelers and the government officials and some diplomatic officers in the country. So this is what we have in Burkina so far.
So we clearly see a common thread here is that the first cases in Africa, or sub-Saharan Africa in particular, were related to travelers coming from abroad, especially from Europe. There is a lot that we do not know about COVID-19 coronavirus, and we'll try to have more understanding today. Our viewers as well have many, many questions, and many of you sent us your video questions, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. Let's begin with a question from Zimbabwe.
At what stage can you tell that you have the disease? How long does it take for you to get sick after you are infected?
And Dr. Karim, let me give you this question. At what stage do you know that you are infected with coronavirus? Talk to us a little bit about the infection.
So given that we didn't know this virus existed before 19th of December, the information and the knowledge we've had is really from the last few months, and most of it is thanks to the detailed research from our colleagues in China. And what we do know is from the date on which a person gets infected, the symptoms appear about a week later, somewhere in the order of 7 to 10 days. The symptoms that are most common are an upper respiratory tract infection. So it's things like fever, which is the most common, cough, sore throat. So when you're looking at a patient who's presenting with this, you can work on the basis that roughly the infection occurred just over a week ago.
Mm-hmm. And at what stage does one need to report to the hospital if they see that the symptoms maybe increase? Because we hear reports where people can stay home and take care of themselves and then report to the hospital. So what is the case then? Let me give you this question, Dr. Sion. Would you enlighten us?
Okay. So I think it depends on the resources that you have and depends on the number of the cases that you have in the country and what your Ministry of Health or what the country is doing. So my experience for the Ethiopian cases have been that if people are quote-unquote high risk, meaning having traveled or exposure with a known COVID-19 or in the areas where we've seen the community spread, people would have to call the number that's provided from the Ministry of Health when they develop symptoms. So then eventually they will get tested if they meet the criteria based on what my colleague had described, where things are changing by the day based on the experiments and based on the studies that are coming up. But again, it depends on what the recommendation from each country.
Okay.
So I think most of the African countries are doing that, where they've isolated or put people inside healthcare institutes. But just to share my experience here in New York, where we have cases in the city over 60,000 as of today, anybody with mild symptoms is told to stay home because we just don't have the capacity to put them in the hospital. But I think in areas where they're trying to flatten the curve and the resources are limited and we're trying to spread the, trying to stop the spread, if anybody's concerned about COVID, they have to call the right number and get the directions from their Department of Health or from their Ministries of Health.
Okay. Now let's go to another question from a viewer in Kenya.
Coronavirus.
How is the coronavirus different from other viruses like flu and others?
Yes, let's talk about the coronavirus and how it differs from the flu and some of the similarities. And again, Dr. Karim, let me come to you. Can you enlighten us with regards to these two diseases?
Sure. So when we look at influenza, we are very used to getting influenza being spread in the communities every winter. It's something we have gotten used to, and every year we get a flu strain coming around. There's quite a big difference between influenza and the coronavirus. So firstly, they're completely different viruses, but also the clinical features of influenza are much more severe than they are with the coronavirus. However, the big difference is that because many of us have had flu in the past, we often have protection against the strain that is occurring. Also, we have a vaccine. So if you take the vaccine that's protective against the strain, then you are not likely to get infected. So we have measures to protect ourselves, either past infection, in other words, natural immunity, or we have vaccination. With the coronavirus, we've never experienced this virus before. Humanity has never seen this. So every one of us is at risk. There's a second big difference. And that is that the influenza, the rate at which it spreads, is that for every person who is infected, that person will infect, on average, one other. With the coronavirus, every person that's infected will infect 2 to 3 other people. It's something called the reproductive rate of infection. But what does that mean in reality? It means that with the coronavirus, if you have 10,000 people infected today, within 2 to 3 days, that number will treble. So it'll become 30,000. Within another 2 to 3 days, you get 90,000 because you're multiplying by close to 3. So that means you can go from a small number to a very large number of people infected in a very short space of time. And so that's what causes this very high numbers of infection. And what happens as a result? We know that about 5% of them are going to need severe serious medical care, including, to some extent, ventilation. So it happens that all of these patients are coming then to the healthcare system about a week later, all of them needing medical care, and the healthcare system just can't deal with it. And so the healthcare system just simply collapses and people start dying because we don't have enough ICU care and we don't have enough ventilators. So that's the big difference.
Okay. And Dr. Kana, let me come to you and ask, what is the case? I know you gave us kind of an overview of what's happening in Nigeria, but as of today, how is the healthcare system able to assist those who are infected with COVID-19?
I think what the government did from the outset is setting up a presidential task force. And then the next thing the president did was also to meet with all the governors. We have 36 plus one states in Nigeria. And each of those states actually, to that extent, are actually independent of one another. You know, therefore, government now set out the criteria for managing the coronavirus in each of the states of the federation. Number one, federal government now asks each of the states to set up a state task team. What it means is that each state must have an emergency operation center to respond to any emergencies as regards coronavirus, one. Secondly, what government did also is to ensure that each state of the federation actually establishes one isolation center of at least minimum 300 beds. There are some states which are bigger, and therefore they can have larger number of facilities. you know, but the minimum is 300 beds per state. Thirdly, the government has put in place a system, a supply chain system, whereby consumables, i.e. the PPE, face masks, and the rest of them will be made available to all the states of the Federation. But the most important, besides the issue of case finding, the next is you have to test. Now, what government did immediately is to reactivate and make functional at least 6 laboratories in the country. Because without testing, there's simply no way you can actually address the issue of corona in the country. Therefore, that's what Nigeria has done so far. And that's what has been helping us. The different parts of the country, laboratories are functional now. And for each case that we found, we do an immediate contact tracing. Now, this work is currently coordinated by the Nigerian Center for Disease Control. Incidentally, this is a center that is new, but quite frankly, doing extremely well in this response,
okay,
making sure that they have a team on ground that can actually be dispatched to any state to provide just not just technical assistance, but to ensure that things are actually working well in each of those states of the Federation. And that's why even in Lagos, we're doing very well in the control in Lagos at the moment.
And contact tracing is very, very important indeed in this situation. Dr. Nyaone, let me come to you. Talk to us about, as a community health specialist, do you have a sense that communities are really grasping the importance of this disease? Because there were issues where people were not taking this seriously. Sometimes they thought that the disease was something that was for the West. How are communities reacting to this COVID-19?
So, yes, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges we have in Africa. People still think that COVID-19 is from Western, that white people are more vulnerable about, like, to COVID. And in Burkina, for example, the disease started from people who traveled. So we see them, the community see them as, rich people. And the first cases you saw, you could see people from the government. So it comforts people who think that, yes, coronavirus is just for rich people. So in our community, people still don't take it serious. They think it's just lie, and they think it's the different barriers they should have, the different behavior they have to take to prevent the disease are too hard to follow. And so they don't think it's something serious so far.
Okay.
This is a challenge.
So and how do you address this challenge with, drawing from your experience, how do you convince communities to understand what the problem is and also to be part of the solution?
So, as I said, it's all about communication. And from my our NGO, we are trying to get volunteers to talk to the community. So the volunteers will come from the community, and by training them about coronavirus and giving them the right information, they are able to use the messages from their own perspective to convince people that coronavirus is something serious. And I think the government of Burkina should do better in presenting the cases. You know, when you see the statistics, they only say 364 people are sick. So from the perspective of people in rural areas, it's just figures.
Yes.
But if they start giving more details, I don't say they should say the name of people, but by saying among those 364 people, 200 are, or 20 people are healthcare workers.
Yes.
100 people are from this perspective. So, I mean, if we have more details, it will convince the community.
So it's really about framing the message in a way that communities understand. And it's very, very important. Let's go to another question. And this one is from Ethiopia.
The first question would be actually regarding with the atmosphere that the virus actually relays on. how long does the virus stay on the surface, particularly in Africa?
Dr. Salim, how long does the virus stays on surface, whether it's cardboard, steel, you know, iron, or even cloth? Do we have some specific and firm information on this?
Yes, we do. So a study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine about 2 weeks ago, they did a study of how long does the virus survive on all different kinds of surfaces. So it survives for a very short time on cardboard and paper, in the order of 8 hours, 10 hours, and that sort of order. It survives longer on plastic, and it survives longest on hard surfaces like stainless steel. So they showed that on stainless steel, the virus is still viable 3 days later. So that's why we're very concerned in particular that when you're dealing with surfaces like stainless steel or iron, you can expect that the virus will, that those items will be contaminated and can transmit the virus up to 3 to 4 days later.
All right. Dr. Sion, let me ask you this. You work in the U.S., a country with the highest numbers currently in the world, and then the city of New York, the city with the highest number in the country. What is your day like when you get to the hospital, briefly? What can you tell us?
Okay, so just to give a bit of a context, about 5 weeks ago, we had only a handful of cases, and the first case was about a month and a half almost. And in the past, and then the following 2 weeks afterwards, the case just grew exponentially to thousands of cases. As of today, New York has over 60,000 cases. And the amount of stress, the amount of constraint that has put on the system is beyond what I could explain. When I walk into my emergency department, before I walk into the emergency department, it's like the streets have changed into an emergency room. We have a tent outside taking care of the mild symptoms. And when you walk into the waiting room, which any other time would have been a waiting room, is now an emergency room where you see patients coughing, complaints of fever, and headache. And our emergency rooms now feel like ICUs, because when you walk into the emergency department, you see a lot of patients on a ventilator because they're unable to breathe on their own, or there are severe respiratory distress from this. So it's almost stretchers and on the hallway and shoulder to shoulder with lots of patients, lots of people, providers. We have not allowed family members to be in the hospitals during this peak season here. And we're witnessing unprecedented amount of death, meaning our morgues are full. So now we have to put bodies inside a refrigerated truck, and this is the case in almost every hospital. And the sad thing is the governor announced yesterday that we're running out of burial spaces that would have to start using park spaces for burials. So as a person who practices in a high-income country and also knows the issues in most of the sub-Saharan Africa, I never thought I would witness things like this in the U.S., where we presume to have lots of resources and also the right amount of human resources as well. So it's just been mind-blowing to witness this in this country. Yeah. And to have shortages of supplies and to continue to have now shortages of medicine. So it's been overwhelming for everyone in healthcare profession in the U.S. in the past few weeks.
And that was part one of our special edition of Straight Talk Africa on addressing coronavirus COVID-19 on the continent. Next week, we will have part two of the town hall discussion. For more on today's show, log on to our website at voanews.com. You can also join me on facebook.com/healthchat, and let's keep the conversation going. I'm your host, Lenore Mudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, be well, don't forget to wash your hands very often, and strive to make every day a healthy day.